Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I think we need to use the school food not just to teach kids what's edible, but to teach them what's going to contribute to health and well-being.
That's author and school food activist Janet Poppendick. In the latest installment of our look at the school lunch system, she talks about the history of the program and gives suggestions for making it better. Hello and welcome. I'm Annie Corrigan. We'll go into the kitchen today with Chef Daniel Orr to cook three belly-warming soup recipes using quinoa, lima beans, and lentils. And in a case of one man's trash is another man's treasure, we talk to a local businesswoman who has come up with a creative way to use Upland Brewing Company's spent barley. Stay with us. We say thank you and good luck to Liz Leslie, who will be retiring from reading our food headlines every week. And now welcome to Mia Partlow, who will be taking over. Hi again, Mia.
Hi, Annie. The debate over raw milk is heating up as new research shows it is 150 times more likely to cause illness than pasteurized milk. While raw milk fans contend the pasteurization process also kills good cultures and degrades proteins, health officials have long argued the risks aren't worth it, since unpasteurized dairy products contain dangerous foodborne pathogens like salmonella, E. coli, and campylobacter. According to the findings of a CDC study set for publication in March, of the disease outbreaks traced to milk between 1993 and 2006, some 60% were the result of raw milk consumption. Many states already have laws in place that regulate, if not ban outright, the sale of unpasteurized milk. A Connecticut lawmaker is introducing a bill that would require foods with genetically modified organisms to be labeled if sold in the state. Representative Richard Roy says the bill has garnered bipartisan support and is expected to pass the Environment Committee, of which he is co-chair. Roy says he's not making a judgment call on GMOs. Rather, he says consumers have the right to know. Currently, no state requires GMOs to be labeled, but 18 states total are considering such a law. Across the United States, food trucks are facing an uphill battle against ordinances like Indianapolis's ban on late-night service. Now a proposal by California State Assemblyman Bill Monning would keep food trucks from parking within 1,500 feet of any school, roughly a three-block radius. The idea is to prevent school children from buying unhealthy lunches. But in areas like San Francisco, where schools are numerous and packed tightly together, this could mean curtains for what has proven to be an extremely successful business model. Opponents of the plan contend most schools don't let kindergarten through ninth graders leave for lunch anyway, and that banning trucks would hurt vendors while doing little to promote nutritious eating. And it doesn't matter if they help you have it your way, fast food workers are more likely to believe their jobs make the world a worse place than other workers. A recent pay scale survey asked 30,000 respondents to rate the, quote, meaningfulness of their jobs. Of the 1% of respondents who said their job has a net negative impact, 42.3% were fast food workers. However, the pay scale survey was opt-in, not random. In other words, the results may not hold up across the population. Read more about these stories and many more on our website, eartheats.org.
And follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Just search for Earth Eats. Mia Partlow, thanks for coming in and looking forward to hearing from you every week.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
The raw milk debate is hitting close to home as well. A small, though growing, community of people in Indiana drink unpasteurized or raw milk, even though it's illegal to buy it. As WFIU's Julie Raw reports, the state is recognizing the increasing popularity and is responding with legislation that would label this type of milk as not for human consumption.
In the parking lot of the grocery co-op Blooming Foods in Bloomington, Indiana, dairy farmer Luke Rhodes unloads coolers of milk bottles, eggs, and frozen pork roast.
Yeah, I was going to have an extra milk and eggs, or two eggs and a...
People trickle in throughout the morning to meet Rhodes at the truck, most of them to pick up bottles of raw milk.
Thank you much.
It's illegal to sell unpasteurized milk in Indiana and most other states. But Rhodes isn't selling it. He's distributing it. The customers here all participate in Rhodes' cow share program.
We had requests of people that wanted to get raw milk off the farm, which we knew was illegal, so we pursued what we could do with it, and we found out the cow share program is legal, and we started out with that about 6 years ago with one cow shareholder, and we're presently up to about 150.
Think of the cow share program this way. Customers come to Rhodes looking to get raw milk. They purchase a share or two of one of his Dutch Golden Dairy cows for $50 apiece and then fill out some paperwork showing they jointly own the cow with other shareholders. Owning part of the cow gives customers the right to drink its milk, and no money changes hands when Rhodes distributes the milk to the shareholders.
Our son drinks it. We believe it helps him with his allergies. It makes a great yogurt. It's great stuff.
Rhodes says he's been drinking raw milk his whole life because he grew up on a farm. He distributes his milk weekly in Bloomington and Indianapolis and says he's surprised at the great lengths so many people are willing to go to get it.
People do go quite a distance to get raw milk. They will. I've heard of people driving as far as an hour, hour and a half, and some families group together and take turns and go.
It's that trend which has some health officials worried. The Food and Drug Administration warns against the dangers of drinking raw milk, and as a result, most state legislators are hesitant to legalize its sale, even in small quantities. State Senator Gene Lysing opposed a bill earlier this month that would have legalized on-farm raw milk sales. Lysing says before raw milk is sold in Indiana, the state will need to establish better regulations.
Having been an old nurse by profession, I'm very worried, I guess, about the scientific side of that issue. This amendment wouldn't have required anything. It would have just legalized the sale of raw milk. And I really felt that that was just an accident waiting to happen.
Each state has its own special legislation dealing with the sale of unpasteurized milk. And just as raw milk advocates go to great lengths to obtain their dairy, regulators try hard to stop them. Some states have measures that are both strict and inventive. Take, for example, the state of North Carolina, which used to require its producers to color their milk gray to make it unappetizing for consumption. Other states, like Wisconsin, have gone the opposite direction and totally legalized direct on-farm raw milk sales. And when it comes to the debate over whether raw milk is healthy or harmful, there is minimal scientific research to support either side. Andrea Wiley is an Indiana University professor of anthropology who researches human milk consumption. She says renewed interest in the living components of food has brought many people to raw milk. She says the debate boils down to bacteria.
Not all the bacteria that are in milk are by definition good. Certainly the conditions under which cows are raised, the ways that they're treated, the ways they're milked, can also introduce other kinds of bacteria that are pathogenic. I think we shouldn't assume that all of the milk coming out of the cow is by definition full of very beneficial bacteria.
If the bill currently in the Indiana Senate passes, bottles of raw milk would be labeled not for human consumption. The idea is that would serve as another deterrent to consumers who are enticed by the product. Another component of the bill would commission a study from the State Board of Animal Health to assess whether Indiana should legalize raw milk sales. For WFIU News, I'm Julie Raw.
Read more food stories from around Indiana on the website indianapublicmedia.org. We're exploring the school food system over the next couple weeks on Earth Eats. Last week, we spoke with blogger and mom Mimi Ito. This week, we speak with a recipient of the 2011 Leadership Award from the James Beard Foundation, Janet Poppendick.
It is a fundamental characteristic of our species that we have to teach our young what's good to eat.
She's also the author of Free for All, Fixing School Food in America. She stopped by the Earth Eats studios in June of 2010.
That's our responsibility as adults. That's part of what rearing children is about. And schools are a very important part of where children learn these things. And I think we need to use the school food not just to teach kids what's edible, but to teach them what's going to contribute to health and well-being. If you treat children like customers, if the culture that surrounds the school cafeteria is, as many food service directors said to me, our kids are our customers, we have to give them what they want, then you're really putting the kids in charge of the menu. And these children are not tabula rasas. These children have been exposed to thousands of television commercials in a typical year, 10 to 12 billion dollars worth of food advertising, and it is not advertising for carrots and apples. So I think it's a problem to start with, but I think it's also important to understand that that comes it's structured into the program because we sell the meals to children. And so, of course, food service thinks of them as customers. And because children have other options, they can go down the hall to the vending machines, they can choose from the a la carte items, they can bring a lunch from home, which may be a fine thing to do, but we have an awful lot of brown bag lunches that are coming in from the corner store, not from home. So children have these other options. And often, if I would raise the issue of too many French fries with food service directors, they would say, well, if we don't offer them here, they're just going to go, you know, down to McDonald's and buy them. The whole phenomenon of open campuses was – I'm really old, and we were not allowed out at lunchtime when I was a student. So the idea of students driving in their cars away from many of the nation's high schools at lunchtime really was quite shocking to me.
In January of 2012, First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign helped draft new guidelines for school lunch nutrition, which now includes more fruits and vegetables, more whole grains, and a gradual reduction of sodium over the next 10 years. But how did the government get involved in providing food for school children in the first place? Papendick traces it all the way back to the 1930s. The Depression started in the farm sector much earlier than in the industrial sector, and surpluses were the biggest problem in the agricultural economy.
And if you have, you know, a few big firms making steel and there's an oversupply, they can cut back on production and the price will go back up. Supply will go down, the price will go up. But when you have millions of individual farmers, cutting back on production by one farm doesn't reduce the overall supply enough to – so farmers tend to work harder and produce more when their price goes down. They're competing for a greater share of a sagging market. So surpluses then build up and it becomes a cycle. And that had been happening all through the 20s when the Roosevelt administration came in, there was particularly a glut on the hog market, and they wanted to reduce the glut of hogs in the coming cycle. So what they did was contract to buy baby pigs from farmers rather than have the farmers keep them and grow them up to be big hogs. The Secretary of Agriculture offered to purchase them as little pigs. And farmers just flooded the terminal markets with baby pigs. And the baby pigs escaped from the – because the pens were built to contain big hogs, not little pigs. And little pigs went squealing down the streets of Chicago and Omaha. And a lot of public sympathy for the baby pigs was expressed. And then the stockyards needed to figure out what to do with the baby pig carcasses because they wouldn't fit through the machinery for butchering. And so they ground them up for something that's called tankage, and it's essentially a kind of liquefied pig. And then they kind of dumped that in some rivers and in some quarries, and then the weather turned hot and blue flies came and a big stench arose and it made headlines all over the place. It was a public relations disaster. But Franklin Roosevelt was a public relations master, and he responded to it by saying, we're going to take the pigs from the pig slaughter, and we're going to distribute this as food to the unemployed, and we're going to create a federal corporation to rescue the farm surpluses and give them to people in need. And so that was created in 1933, and by 1935 they began donating that food to schools.
Janet Papendick is the author of Free for All: Fixing School Food in America. She's also a professor at Hunter College, City University of New York. Read and listen to the complete Earth Eats interview on our website, eartheats.org. Our first recipe today is the first of three soups. In spite of the seesawing temperatures in the area, it's still February, so Chef Daniel Orr suggests these recipes as a way to warm you up. The star of this dish is yellow lentils.
Well, lentils have been grown for 13,000 years about. A lot of people have been eating them ever since then. A lot of times it happened in the Middle East and North Africa that they would cook them with barley and other grains and make a real nutritious kind of mush to eat.
Well, I know lentils are a favorite of my vegetarian friends out there because they're a really fantastic source of protein. But you have to know a little bit to get all of the protein out of lentils.
Well, you always want to do food combining when you're trying to make a perfect protein. So, you know, you think about those cultures that had a lot of vegetarian dishes like the Mexicans. They always had the corn, the beans, the rice. And when you combine all those together, then you get a perfect protein, and that gives you a lot of nutritional value.
Are you ready to make some soup?
Yes.
We're going to do a yellow lentil soup today. And in the recipe, it does call for some stock, but you could just as easily use water. So if you want to make it vegetarian, you can use water. If you want to make it vegan, you don't have to put the sour cream or yogurt in at the end if you don't want to. All right, so we're going to get started by adding the extra virgin olive oil to our pot and quickly following it with the chopped garlic. Okay, and you're looking for that kind of roasty, toasty aroma to come through. The garlic will just start to turn a little bit brown, and that's when you want to have your other vegetables ready, because you don't want that garlic to burn or it will get bitter. All right, so we've got our onions. You know, I don't know if everyone can afford it in their household, but it's always great to have one piece of equipment, and that's called a sous chef. All right, so
you've got like six or seven of those around here.
Yeah, we've got quite a few around here. So it makes it a lot easier. You can just start, you know, you arrive and everything's ready for you.
You know, you've got a young niece or nephew wandering around. Put them to work, right?
Absolutely. All right, we're just going to stir those around, coat them with that oil and garlic mixture. Okay, we're going to toss in the carrots, tomatoes. Okay, and then we've got our red lentils. Lentil actually comes from the word lens, and these look like little eye lenses. Okay, I'm adding some water. You see all those nice veggies in there. We're going to bring that to a boil. The other things that you could add to this, if at this point, if you'd like, you could throw in a bay leaf, some rosemary. You know, there's lots of ways that you can dress this up. They could throw some crab meat in this, which would be great. Some shrimp. You could always put a little bowl of bacon out there. People could sprinkle some bacon. They could put some sour cream on top of it when it's done. You know, use the recipe as a guideline, but don't act like you're reading the Bible. All right, I'm going to finish by adding a little bit of the chili powder and then some salt. We're going to cover this, bring it to a boil, and let it simmer for 20 minutes, and you got soup.
But you don't just need to make a soup if you want lentils. You can use lentils in any number of different ways.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are so many different types of lentils as well. One of my favorite are the lentilles de Puy, which are the French green lentils that grow in a volcanic area of France. And they've just got this really deep flavor that you can use with anything. I love to toss the lentilles de Puy, but you could use any type of lentils with some walnut vinaigrette. Makes a really nice salad. I like to combine lentils with fish because then you get kind of that surf and turf.
Lentils are just generally a great item to have in your pantry, especially if you try to avoid gluten. You can substitute wheat products for lentils and make breads, for instance. Visit our website to see this recipe and check out the many other recipes that use lentils. From eartheats.org, click on Archives and then Recipes. Coming up, we don't stray too far from the kitchen. Two more soup recipes using lima beans and quinoa. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, offering local, organic, and fair trade natural foods with cafe seating on East 3rd Street at the co-op's original location off Kirkwood and on West 6th Street, two blocks west of the Courthouse Square. Information at bloomingfoods.coop. And from Goods for Cooks, Bloomington's premier culinary arts store, offering hard-to-find and everyday kitchen items, serving Bloomington and the surrounding area since 1973, located downtown on the west side of the square and online at goodsforcooks.com.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Twisted Limb Paperworks has been an innovator in sustainably produced stationery since 1998, creating handmade, 100% recycled products from office paper, junk mail, and grocery bags. Sometimes more unusual materials find their way into the paper, like grass clippings. Most recently, they've started using the spent barley from Upland Brewing Company to create 4 beer-inspired colors of paper, a process that is garnering national buzz. I stopped by the shop to get the scoop on Twisted Limb's beer paper.
I'm very excited about this, and I'm a little anxious because we are the first people, or the first studio to ever make beer paper.
In the state?
Ever.
Ever?
Ever.
So naturally, Cheryl Woodhouse Keyes, the founder and owner of Twisted Limb Paperworks, is a little shy about sharing the details of her papermaking process. Her beer paper, using spent barley from Upland Brewing Company, is getting a lot of attention from beer clubs and breweries all over the country who want it for invitations, thank you cards, and menus. She says the idea for beer paper started when she was trying to find a uniquely local spin for her business.
But I really kind of wanted to come up with things from the Bloomington environment that we could recycle that were kind of more novel than just the grass out of my lawn.
She considered using the algae that was growing on Griffey Lake, but that idea fell through. It was after attending a community meeting with Doug Dayhoff, president of Upland, that she decided to pursue the possibility of using barley. Upland produces 20,000 pounds of spent grain on an average week. Twisted Limb takes a small fraction of that, 2 5-gallon buckets, with the rest of the waste going to a local farmer and a landscaping company.
And he warned me, he says, I'm just going to tell you right now, it is going to stink really bad, so you will have to decide quickly what you're going to do with it. And I said, no worries, we are used to things smelling here. But I'll be honest, the barley takes the cake. It smells worse than anything in 14 years that we had ever experienced.
Once she figured out how to store the stuff, the next step was finding the proper ratio of barley to recycled paper, because Woodhouse Keyes determined she couldn't make paper from barley alone. After some experimenting, she came up with 4 beer-inspired colors: wheat, pilsner, porter, and her personal favorite, amber. It's the amount of which colors of recycled papers she uses that she's especially concerned about keeping under wraps.
2 of the colors we made very quickly because we have similar colors. The Pilsner and the Porter were easy for us, but then we patted ourselves on the back and then we struggled for the next month. The wheat was easier and the amber eluded us for some time. It's quite close. But given this is my favorite beer, I want that color to be just right. And I'd say I have it 99% where I want it to be.
Yeah, can we take a look at some?
Yes, and I'll let you smell the barley, too.
Let me. That's a funny way to put that. Here's...
Ooh. Yeah. This is gentle. This is really nothing compared to the day I came in here.
It's a relatively small Ziploc bag. When you get the barley from Upland, how much are we talking?
Just a couple of 5-gallon buckets.
How much paper are you going to make with 2 5-gallon buckets?
A lot.
Is this not what you want to talk about?
Yes, I don't want to talk about
it.
I don't
want to. Yeah.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because you want to shout about it and tell everybody because everybody loves it. So I think that's just part of being in business, though, that once you put the idea out there, it is sort of fair game. And at least you can say you were the first, right?
You can visit Twisted Limb Paperworks at their store on South Morton Street on the Beeline Trail in Bloomington. Get more information about Cheryl Woodhouse Keyes' beer paper by visiting their website, twistedlimbpaper.com. Quinoa is high in protein, but not only that, it's a complete protein, which means it contains a balanced set of essential amino acids. It's also high in iron, dietary fiber, and it's gluten-free. You can sprout the stuff, and unlike the 12 hours it takes to sprout wheat, it only takes quinoa 2 to 4 hours to grow its little tendrils. It's no wonder this little seed has been called a superfood.
So simple to cook. Basically, all you do is you pour it into a pan, cover it with water, and cook it. And you just need to keep adding water until you see these little kind of white, wormy-looking things. Doesn't sound very appealing, but it's really, really tasty. If you just grab a little handful of that, I put a little bit of garlic, salt and pepper, and a little olive oil with it. I had some smoked turkey broth, put the quinoa in there, some carrots, some collard greens. You could throw leeks, you could throw turnips, you could throw parsnips, anything you want in there. And then the kumquats, the little oranges that are in there, give it a really fun, interesting flavor and make it very different. And they have a nice citrus pop as you eat them. It's a way to add excitement to those kind of late winter dishes.
Those kumquats are little fireballs that explode when you bite into them. They sure do add an interesting zing to the soup. Try it for yourself. Print off the recipe at eartheats.org. Lima beans are also on the menu today. We're cooking them from dry, but you can soak them ahead of time if you like. They'll certainly cook faster that way. What you do is add one part beans to three parts water and soak them for 6 hours before you start cooking.
We've got some nice lima beans here, and the first thing you always want to do is look at the lima beans. Any kind of bean, a lot of times, especially the smaller beans, there could be some rocks or stones or non-bean-like material inside. So it's always important, and it's getting better now through processing. The next thing you want to do is to take them over to the sink and give them a rinse. You know, you're doing that just to rinse off any kind of powder, or there might be some insect material on them. Now, the thing about cooking them from dry yourself is that you can inject a lot of flavor into the beans. So we're starting that by adding a little bit of olive oil. And about, I like garlic, so about a good tablespoon, two tablespoons.
Or a fistful, folks.
Three tablespoons of garlic. And we're just going to let that start to brown a little bit. Now, this is one of my secrets that I do for a lot of different things. Start with a decent, not excellent olive oil. You brown your garlic, and then we're going to add our rosemary. And this gives it a real tustic, kind of Tuscan rustic or a tustric flavor. It's great if you're starting a tomato sauce, even if you buy some canned tomato sauce and you want to make it taste fresh. And it will taste like you've been cooking it for hours when you've just made a quick sauce. Okay, I'm going to add my washed beans to that. Okay, and to that I'm going to add a 15-ounce can of chopped tomatoes. Kind of stir that around. I'm going to throw in about half an onion. You could use red onion or white onion. I also like to sometimes throw some root vegetables in. And then I'm just going to top it off with water, bring it to a boil, let it simmer, and just cook it until the beans get soft. And I like these beans to be pretty soft. They've come almost silky when they're really cooked through. You could use this as a soup, or you could use it to serve a piece of roast fish over, and serve it with some crusty bread, and it's almost like a sauce. Fresh lemon juice, and you're good to go.
There you have it. See all the recipes from today's show on our website. While you're there, join the conversations our bloggers are having about raising backyard chickens, cooking with extra virgin olive oil, and your preferred ingredients in tacos. It's all at eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, offering local, organic, and fair trade natural foods with cafe seating on East 3rd Street at the co-op's original location off Kirkwood and on West 6th Street, two blocks west of the Courthouse Square. Information at bloomingfoods.coop. And from Goods for Cooks, Bloomington's premier culinary arts store, offering hard-to-find and everyday kitchen items, serving Bloomington and the surrounding area since 1973, located downtown on the west side of the square and online at goodsforcooks.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Next week, it's nothing but the sweet stuff, artisanal marshmallows and real home-tapped maple syrup. Be sure to join us for that. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.